Next case for argument, Smith v. Potter. Mr. Jones.
May it please the Court, my name is Stuart Jones for the appellant. Preliminary point, I delivered a letter to the Court pertaining to several changes. I inadvertently included the wrong decision. Hopefully the Court saw the right decision in the appellee's brief. In addition, I wish to retract the statement saying that we agreed that the with the lower court judge that there was an identity of causes of action.
I was a little surprised to see you say that, but the rest of your brief didn't say that. So
okay.
We assumed.
Thank you. Briefly summarizing the facts, Mrs. Smith filed her first sexual harassment claim against the Postal Service in December of 2004. Unfortunately, service was not timely. Rather than wait for the court to inevitably rule that it would be dismissed, we went ahead and moved to voluntarily dismiss the
case.
Now,
was she pro se during part of that?
No.
First, she was represented throughout?
Yes, she was.
Okay.
She filed a second, the first case.
Where did the dismissal with prejudice come from? Whose idea was that?
That was Judge Manning.
So your client hadn't moved to dismiss with prejudice?
No, Your Honor. The first case was against, named two men and a woman as being the harassers, and that was, as I say, was dismissed. Unfortunately, Ms. Smith believed that the harassment continued after the filing of the complaint during the spring and the summer of 2005.
Excuse me, Mr. Jones. For some reason, Judge Manning says in her order, the docket currently shows that plaintiff is proceeding pro se. This was a June 7, 2005. Order that's entered. So at some point, was an appearance entered for her?
Yes, there was. I don't remember the exact timing, Your Honor.
All right.
In any case, in the second suit that she filed, she pursued her.
In the first suit, when she filed her notice of dismissal, had the defendant filed anything? Filed an answer or what?
No, they filed a motion to dismiss in the first suit. In the second suit, they filed a motion for summary judgment based on res judicata.
Well, and the reason we're asking is because under Rule 41A1, if the defendant hasn't filed an answer yet, unless the notice of dismissal filed by the plaintiff says otherwise, it's a dismissal without prejudice.
Well, that would change things radically.
It makes it easier for you, assuming this is an argument you can raise at this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you've never argued that.
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Well, I didn't see that rule. I assumed that it was with prejudice, and there was really no recourse at that point. In any case, Judge Dara, the court below, dismissed the matter based on res judicata, and we're submitting an appeal that there was no identity of the causes of action under the rule set out in Lee versus Peoria, that neither set of, first of all, the parties involved in the first, the accused harassers in the first case were two men and a woman, whereas in the second case it was a year later. And in this case, it was five women involved.
Well, it seems to me there are two different things that conceivably could be important, although I actually think only one of them is. One of them would be the time at which the first complaint is filed, kind of closing the set of what the transaction or occurrence being complained of in the first case might be concerned with. The second, I mean, you're saying that there were other people, but if in fact those other people had all been involved in that earlier time frame so that she could have complained about a hostile environment at the Postal Service during that earlier time frame, you would have much more trouble, I think, with identity of claim. But if your real point is that things that happened after the first complaint, at least for purposes of a damages action, can't be part of the earlier transaction or occurrence,
cannot be part
because you couldn't have, I mean, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? So
right.
Once you've complained, you're complaining about a closed set of events.
Yes, Your Honor. And Wright and Miller and Judge Aspin in the Green case both proposed that.
Such emphasis on the Green case.
Well, it was the only case I could...
District court case, as if it were more important, you know, had greater precedential significance than court of appeals decisions.
Well, the reference...
Saying district court opinions do not have precedential effect.
Based upon Wright and Miller, which is a high, you know, authority that's...
So you're just saying it's persuasive.
Persuasive, yes, Your Honor. And there's a, because of the uniqueness of this particular set of circumstances, there are really, I couldn't find much precedent in any of the circuits. So basically I had to rely on what
I was
available.
Would you find any? You don't need much.
Well, nothing within the EEO environment in this
particular
area. Why
is that important?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Why is that important?
Well, because I think that that's one of the reasons that both Judge Aspin and Wright and Miller, well, Judge Aspin feels that EEO cases are unique in respect to res judicata law
because
of the administrative...
Because of the commission's role?
Excuse me?
Because of the commission's role?
Correct, and particularly in this case where it's an administrative agency where you're required to exhaust administrative remedies, and there's a 45-day rule at that
what does that
level.
Have to do with res judicata?
Well, it's the disruptive effect of having to go back and forth between EEOC every time there's a new violation. It seems to me that the plaintiff is required to go back and refile with the administrative agency each time there's an EEO violation occurring, and that would presumably because of the history of this case, going all the way back to sexual harassment, going all the way back to 1999, it appeared that the harassment was going to be continuing all the way up ad infinitum, and that would require multiple reopenings of discovery and new depositions, and that creates such disruption, the same disruption that Wright and Miller talk about as being a good rule not to apply res judicata in this type of a situation. There are several other arguments as well, and that is that Judge Madera read and placed emphasis on Green himself and seemed to misinterpret Judge Aspin's careful distinction between...
You're still harping on the Green case.
Well, only because Judge Guerra made an essential part of his decision.
I don't understand what EEOC has to do with the res judicata. I don't get that.
Well,
suppose there's no EEOC, no requirement of complaining. How would that... What then would be the proper disposition of this case?
Well, Your Honor, I can see your point, and I think it may phrase that way. It doesn't appear that there is a relationship, but nevertheless, there is the disruptive effect of the requirement to go to EEOC.
What does that have to do with res judicata?
Well, where there are facts that occur after the filing.
Well, that can occur in any case, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, they did, and they were substantial.
And you would be making, I think the point is, you would be making the same argument whether there was or wasn't an EEOC. You would still be saying the certainty of the date on which the lawsuit is commenced as closing off the earlier period for claim preclusion purposes is a valuable thing to have. I think it would be surprising to me if you had a different position if there were
yes,
no
sure.
EEOC.
And Wright and Miller also make the point that the plaintiff is put in a terribly difficult position trying to decide whether the particular facts of any new developments after the first filing would require an amendment or do they require a brand new lawsuit. And Wright says that they would really need the guidance of a judge in order to make that determination. So in lieu of having that difficult situation arise, they propose that a bright line rule be applied. They call it the better rule, so that there is no res judicata effect for events that occur after the initial filing. So in light of those arguments, I'd ask the court to
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Lawrenson?
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to first address the first point that the court raised regarding the significance of the fact that the Judge Manning included with prejudice language in the order. First of all, it is waived. not just by the fact that it wasn't argued here, but also because to the extent that there was a problem with that.
What do you mean the extent to which there was a problem?
There wasn't, and let me go straight to that point. The reason that Judge Manning, or at least I don't know what her reason was, but the reason that it was appropriate that it included with prejudice language was by that time, more than 90 days had passed since the right to sue letter or the final agency decision. So any refiling of the complaint by that time would necessarily have been barred by the time limits for filing the EEO case.
Why do you say that, since there might be equitable tolling during the period of time or some other thing that would effectively extend that 90-day period? Judge Manning just blew it, right? I mean, it was a voluntary dismissal. It was something the plaintiff has the right to do. You hadn't answered. And there are cases in which we've said that trying to make a judgment on the merits after such a dismissal is actually a void act.
Well, we know that it wouldn't have been able to be brought and there'd be no equitable tolling because she actually did exercise her rights within 90 days.
One is very clear. It's very clear. And so are our decisions which say that a judgment entered with prejudice under 41A1 is void.
Your Honor, that might be the case. So let's.
What do you mean that might be the case? You're not aware of these cases, but it is the case.
I don't think it changes the result of
this
case.
You didn't notice it in your briefs, right?
It doesn't.
You mentioned 41A1.
It just doesn't change the result.
Yes, it does.
Well, Your Honor, at that point.
Well, your other res judicata arguments, I think, are frivolous.
Pardon?
I think your res judicata arguments are frivolous.
Well, Your Honor, there's Seventh Circuit law on that covers all of these issues. What should have happened here, the real question is this the same set of facts?
And how can it be the same set of facts when it covers a time period after the complaint is filed? People would constantly having to be amending, discovery would have to be reopened, you'd have chaos in claim preclusion law if you had some duty to bring into a lawsuit later events. That's different from the duty to raise all of the claims that you have under a particular constitutional case, quote unquote.
Well, the reason that she brought all those claims is because in her original complaint, it was by far general enough to allege all ongoing harassment. That's
so
what she alleged.
How about this case? Suppose it's a simple case of trespass and somebody decides to bring a lawsuit against his neighbor because the neighbor is constantly trespassing on his property. And the lawsuit is brought on November 1st, 2007, and it asks for damages from the trespass, and it also asks for an injunction against future trespasses. And now, on January 1st, 2008, the neighbor trespasses again. Are you telling me that the person cannot bring a new lawsuit against the new trespass?
Well, the remedy would be to go to the district court and say there has been a contempt of court here, Your Honor.
Why? Why can't you bring a new lawsuit? I mean, one of the reasons for an injunction is that the remedy at law is cumbersome if you have to keep going in and bringing new lawsuits. But where is it said that you cannot bring a new lawsuit for a brand new trespass that had never occurred at the time you filed your lawsuit?
If the facts were entirely different, Your Honor.
I'm asking you for my trespass case. Would you agree that you can bring a new lawsuit for the January 1st, 2008 trespass?
Yes.
Okay. So why is her case different?
Because in her case, what she did is she alleged ongoing discrimination of the same exact type as in her first case.
But so what? I mean, she's bringing, for all she knew, it was going to end. I mean, we don't know. She brings the first case. Maybe the Postal Service woke up and said, gee, you know, we need to have a more congenial atmosphere. We're going to speak to people. This kind of inappropriate and rude behavior is going to stop. And why isn't it available to a litigant when a new set of events happens, even though it's similar to an old set of events?
It's because her original complaint alleged all of those events, and she knew it wasn't going
to. Future events? How can she say, I'm clairvoyant, here's my crystal ball, next week somebody's going to make an off-color remark about, my sexual preference.
Well, she did say that, though. That's exactly what she said in her complaint. She said it's ongoing harassment. She predicted exactly what...
Meaning that it had been ongoing for a long time, and that's what the law requires, severe or pervasive. This would be pervasive.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the essential fact here is that what she predicted in her complaint...
So if it happened 10 years in the future, you would say she's still claim precluded?
If she had pursued her original complaint... 10 years in the future, if it's different management, if it's different...
No, what if it's the same management? It's a very stable place to work.
If it was the same management...
In your effort to win this case, you're screwing up the law of res judicata. It makes things immensely complicated. Every time someone files a suit, the defendant, under your view, goes back into history, looks at the previous cases this person may have filed, and then makes your argument. Well, really, that previous case anticipated this case? It's just a mess.
Your Honor, the RoboServe case kind of addressed this.
No,
silly.
It's not like RoboServe.
It's so silly.
Well,
it's a waste of time.
Your Honor, we would respectfully suggest that when the plaintiff asks for an injunction in the case, as she did, that the court was well-equipped in this first suit to end all of the discrimination that she complained about. They could have even removed her from that management and all of those people. They could have given her front pay and removed her from the Postal Service, allowed her to be completely taken out of the Postal
Service. Why does asking for an injunction make any difference?
It makes a difference because the court, at the time of the first case, had the ability to remedy the entire problem, the problem that she claims continued.
Yeah, you bring suit for seeking injunction on day one, and on day two, you incur some additional harm. So why does the fact that you asked for an injunction preclude you from asking for damages for the harm you incurred before the injunction was issued?
Well, there's no doubt that she would have, under your hypothetical, she would have been able to recover those damages from day two. She,
you know, the fact she asked for an injunction in the first case doesn't make any difference.
It's the critical difference that she asked for a case.
No, you said it didn't make any difference.
It means the injunction.
Look,
the
in day one, she brings a suit. She asks for an injunction. Now, it takes a while to get the injunction. On day two, she incurs some further harm as a result of the defendant's conduct that she's seeking to enjoin. And I said, could she get damages for that harm? And you said yes. So it wouldn't make any difference whether she'd sued for damages the first time or for the injunction.
Your Honor, on day 500, when the court rendered a decision
day
in the
500,
case?
Day 500, day two, before any injunction has been rendered. After the injunction has been rendered, if the defendant violates the injunction, she has an option. She can bring a new suit, or she can seek a remedy for contempt, right?
Correct.
But so the fact she brought an injunction, the first asked for an injunction, doesn't bear on anything.
But the injunction on day two, the court could have issued, she could have asked for and issued an injunction that would have removed her from the Postal Service and given her front pay, preventing any further damages. That is the point.
You get an injunction the day after you file a suit.
Well, you don't, but that was your hypothetical.
No, you don't listen to me.
I apologize, Your Honor.
You file on day one your suit. You ask for an injunction. I said very clearly it takes a while to get an injunction. On day two, you're injured by the defendant. You haven't gotten the injunction yet. So you can get damages, as you admit.
Correct.
It doesn't matter whether it's day two, day 100, day 500. Suppose it's after the injunction is issued. Defendant violates the injunction. You can seek contempt, but you can bring a new suit.
My point would be, Your Honor, that if, under your hypothetical, as I now understand it, the case proceeds to trial, yes, at the end of that trial, that first suit, she can get damages for what happened on day two. I agree with that. However, on the date of the judgment, the date that the trial court renders the opinion, it has the capability of issuing an injunction that stops the damages. That's what she should have done in this case. I'm not saying that the new conduct that she alleges arose after the date of the filing of the first complaint, I'm not saying she can't get damages for that. I'm saying that what she should have done is proceeded with that complaint to get all of her damages up until the date of judgment, if that was necessary, and then relied on the courts to issue an injunction that would stop future damages?
No.
Thank you, Your Honor. We respectfully request that you affirm the district court's opinion.
Mr. Jones, do you have anything further?